This episode of Mecha Dragon is split into two parts. The first, in which we primarily discuss the first season of Loki, is presented here. The second, which is our extended conversation about what Loki Season 1 means for the future of the MCU, will be released as a separate episode in less than a week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Mecha Dragon. Today, we are talking about Season 1 of Loki and how it will affect the future of the MCU. Now, I'm Will, as usual. I am here with Fred Chambers, host of the Imagine Tomorrow podcast. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Hi there. I'm really excited to discuss Loki Season 1 today. I'm just, you know, ecstatic over how it changes the MCU and lays out a very bright and potentially complicated future for us.
Slightly complicated, I would say, from the look of things. So if you haven't guessed by now, dear listener or dear watcher, if you're watching us on YouTube, there will be massive spoilers for Loki Season 1, every episode, as well as potentially any MCU movie that's been released up to this point. And if we're on point with literally any of our predictions at all for the future of the MCU, potentially some spoilers for future installments of the MCU. So just a little spoiler warning for everybody. I know how everybody likes those. So also, just for those of you listening to the show as an audio podcast, I'd urge you to check us out on YouTube, which has become a new platform of ours. So with that housekeeping out of the way, let's get down to talking about Loki and the future of the MCU, because I have a feeling we have a lot to say.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, so I wanted to start just briefly by asking you, what are your general impressions of Loki Season 1, like the whole season? I mean, you can talk about specific episodes if you want, but I'm looking for your general impressions of the show so far. And if you're going to rate the show on a scale of 1 to 10, like how many jet skis out of 10 would you give the show?
I think personally, I would give it 9 jet skis out of 10. 9 jet skis.
That's a big number.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you really liked it. So what do you think, you know, generally about the show brought it to that level for you?
When it comes to Loki, you know, going into the show, I definitely didn't have too many expectations. It was more of a thing of like I was looking to be surprised, because from everything that we had heard, you know, involving the TVA and bringing all these things, it's bringing in these very obscure comic book ideas and bringing them into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So who knows what we're going to get out of that? You know, you have these really interesting ideas involving time and how things are going to be depicted into, you know, the future. And, you know, even taking the character of Loki and giving him 6 hours to be analyzed and, you know, go through a separate journey. You know, I don't remember what the exact number of hours it is that Loki has appeared in the MCU, but it is the sort of thing that you're getting 6 hours straight of Loki as a character on screen. And going into the show itself, there's so much more sort of discussion and conversations that are had between Loki and the character of Mobius that are just a lot of philosophical discussions about who Loki is and what his place is in the universe and where he's come and where he's potentially going. You know, it's one of those things that you're getting to analyze a character, and that's what I've really enjoyed with all of the Disney Plus Marvel shows. And Loki in particular, going in, just having that whole idea of the TVA, I was already getting excited, because anything involving time travel in Marvel lends towards a particular character, which we will talk about later on, that personally I gravitate towards.
Yeah, that's great. You know, for me, I think I actually have to give it a 9 as well. And, I don't think it's necessarily a perfect show. Every episode was maybe not perfect. However, you know, you hit on a couple topics that were also really big for me in the show. Like, this show went to an insane comic booky level that I don't know if we've seen in the MCU before, you know, with introducing the timeline and this, like, all this crazy, you know, timeline hopping, time travel stuff. The TVA itself is so weird, you know, and so, you know, sci-fi fantasy. And But at the same time, you have, you have this incredible character arc that Loki goes on, right? Where the other thing too is like when it starts, it's actually starting from Loki's point of view from the first Avengers movie, essentially, back in 2012, way before he went through all of this other stuff, you know, that we've seen him go through in all the movies after that. Thor: The Dark World, you know, Ragnarok, Endgame, all of that stuff. He hasn't, you know, at the beginning of the show, he hasn't gone through all of that. No, he does. They ultimately show him that stuff. And I think that that actually affects him deeply, as much as he might try and like play it off, you know, later and things like that. But, you know, because of that, I thought the music was absolutely fantastic. Like the music really blew me away. I'm glad they went so big and bold with it. And it has, you know, that sort of weird, like, you know, theremin sort of, you know, in it and giving it kind of like a like an otherworldly sort of feel. And so for all, you know, all those reasons, and I, you know, I've always been big into the multiverse concept. And that's one of the things I really enjoy from the comics and from other, you know, other IPs where, you know, they play with the multiverse and, you know, parallel universes and things like that. So I was really happy to see, like, basically see the genesis of that in the MCU, essentially. Which is what you got behind there, which I'm really digging there, the branching of the of the timeline.
The branching of the timelines, yes.
Yeah, so for
infinite
those reasons, I mean, right, exactly. You know, and now we have infinite possibilities in the MCU, right, which we're going to get to. But, you know, for all those reasons, and I also really liked the exploration of this new character, Sylvie, right? I thought Sylvie's really interesting, you know, and we're going to talk a little bit more about her. But I guess for me, it was such a big swing for Marvel to do this show. And I have heard a lot of, this is something I wanted to get your thoughts on as well. I've heard some chatter online, let's say, that because this show went so weird and so deep into like this crazy like timeline stuff, and at the end you have Jonathan Majors' character, like his version of Kang, like explaining all this stuff, right? Do you think that that makes the show harder to get into for more casual, like, viewers of the MCU?
I think it does, because what this show is really doing is doing all the heavy lifting for the future of Phase 4 and onwards. And going into the show, a lot of people didn't know that. And so when they're going through the initial episodes, and this is where there are some fair criticisms for the series, is that there's a lot less of the action that people are used to. And it's a lot more of a sit down. Two people for an entire episode can just sit down in a room and talk and just have a debate and have a conversation. And I can personally see all the drama and, you know, sort of how that plays in and elevates parts of the MCU and elevates certain characters. You know, you're allowing Loki to see his future, you know, at least in the main MCU, and then react to it. And that's something that's fascinating, is imagine if you could view your own life and see, you know, all the mistakes that you potentially made. And
yeah, you're not just your past, but your future, right? Like the future that hasn't quite come yet, but now that you've been told. Yeah, it's really fascinating. That's
then,
the other thing
no
you mentioned.
For him to return, you know, he's now in the TVA. He's now stuck where he is. And even watching him go through, you know, the early parts of the series where he's, you know, kind of being mischievous and trying to figure his way out of the situation. You know, he finds the Infinity Stones. He's like, what, you know, what's going on here? And he has that moment where he realizes, is this the greatest power in the universe? And it is the sort of thing that he as a character is humbled by this series. And has
which
to,
for Loki is saying a lot, right?
It says so much. And his whole character is kind of going through this process. And the director was talking about this, of the story is about self-love and accepting yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Loki hasn't been able to do that as a character because he's being rushed through the MCU, you know, from one action scene to another. And yeah, that's most of the characters anyway. But I do think, you know, getting back to the original question, is this an approachable series? Is this something that somebody can sit down and watch if they're, you know, familiar with the Marvel movies, but not really familiar with anything else? Well, I think they can. If they gravitate towards the character of Loki, if they, you know, gravitate towards Tom Hiddleston's performance and they feel like they can get into that, then it makes everything a little bit easier to go through. I think once you get to the finale, which for us, you know, who are comic book fans or familiar with the comic book stories, you know, we're losing our minds at how it's expanding everything. For somebody who's just used the MCU, they might not be aware of the gravity of the situation or what this implies, you know, and that's one of those things of it's not a situation that you can't enjoy it or can't understand what's happening, but you'll have different levels of understanding based off of how familiar you are with Marvel and even comic book ideas such as the multiverse. And that's one of those things of some people just have a vague understanding of what the multiverse can mean. You know, they look at Spider-Man Far From Home or whatever it is. It's like, oh, this means something, you know, whatever's happening with WandaVision, you know, this means something. But, you know, as we move forward, there will be more repercussions that call back to this show and call back to Jonathan Majors' performance at the end in the season finale.
Yeah. And in fact, I think one of the key concepts that you actually brought up on this question is Loki's journey through the show so far. So like, okay, yeah, maybe at the end, if you're a casual viewer, you might not quite get everything that Kang, you know, they didn't call him Kang in the show, I guess, but Jonathan Majors' character is saying, or you maybe could call him Immortus, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe some of that's flying over your head or you don't quite get it. But I think that Marvel does this great job of grounding it with like an emotional realism, like, Because you know, if you're lost by that, like, that's not what you're latching onto, right? You're still following Loki's journey and even Sylvie's journey at this point and their journey together. And so, and it's, you know, those last couple scenes were really emotional for Loki, you know, for various reasons. So I think that I don't 100% agree with this notion that it's going to be alienating to more casual, you know, viewers. I mean, maybe some people are feeling a little bit lost about the wonky, like, you know, timeline info dump or something, but I think that at the end of the day they're still going to be there for the character stuff, which you need to have. I mean, that's, you know, that's the story part of it. Like, all this other stuff is really interesting to us, like hardcore nerds and stuff, but, you know, and we can see the possibilities for the future of the MCU, and it gives us that to like sink our teeth into. But at the end of the day, it was a story about Loki and his journey, right? So,
and it never deviates from that, even in the finale where you have, you know, Loki and Sylvie sort of now coming at odds at the very end, their relationship sort of breaking apart. It's still at its heart is about those characters and about Loki. It's not, you know, even though we have, you know, He Who Remains in the background, you know, telling us all this stuff and giving us all this information, it's still in the end still about Loki and Sylvie. So I think that's something that some people that I noticed online discussions of, some people felt like, oh, and now the series has to do what all Marvel, you know, movies and shows do and push the MCU forward, and we abandon the characters. It's like, well, no, they didn't get abandoned. Their story is still continuing. They're still very much involved, even though there are other things going on in the background. And even, you know, going through the show, there are moments where you'll have like, oh, it's hinting at this comic story or this character pops up. Well, that's fun for those of us who know what's going on there. For people who are just watching the series, you know, these are just things that happen throughout the series, and it's just for comedic value, or it's just adding to that sort of weird feeling that the TVA has and that the show has. It's very much, this is Doctor Who in the Marvel universe. That's what this is.
That is so crazy that you mentioned that, because I think it was at the third episode where they're on Lamentis. That episode felt so much like a Doctor Who episode to me. Like, it really did. Like, just from the crazy, like, cosmic, like, setting of it to the fact that they're sort of, like, on this weird mission and the world is ending and, you know, they're kind of traveling together and getting into these hijinks. Like, I don't know what it was, but there was a huge, like, Doctor Who flavor to that episode. Did that also jump out to you, and that one in particular?
Oh, most definitely. Just the way that you were going about it, even just sort of the bottle location, just the way it was all filmed and everything.
Yeah.
It felt very much like, yes, this is a Doctor Who episode in the middle of your Loki series. You know, that even adds to the music. The music sounds very Doctor Who.
It kind of does, yeah, actually, now that you mention it. So I'll just say one more thing on this topic of the season as a whole, which is something you mentioned, which is like, this show throws quite a few philosophical questions at you. But it doesn't do it in like a dry, pedantic, you know, academic sort of way. It's all woven into the story, which is something that Marvel has been pretty good at doing, in my opinion. You know, there's this question of, utilitarianism, because, you know, the gambit at the end is like, well, do you have one dictator who, you know, who's kind of evil and who restricts, you know, free will? Or do you have infinite dictators who burn all of reality? And then there's also, you know, questions about, self-love and like a whole bunch of stuff that I think we'll also get into. But we were talking a little bit about the character journey. And, you know, that brings me to my next topic, which is, you know, what do you think of Loki's character arc through the season? And, you know, how do you think this Loki variant, the main character of the show, that Loki, compares to the character of Loki that we followed through the MCU before this, who ends up in dying in Avengers Endgame, right? And were you satisfied with his arc in the show? And how do you think it relates to the, you know, the themes of the show?
Well, I think that there's a stark difference between the character that dies in Infinity War, you know, that Loki, and the Loki that we have now, who branches off from 2012 and goes on this entire journey and kind of sees that life and is making other choices, and even seeing how things, you know, he should go about things slightly differently or think about his actions. But for this character, you know, he's going through this, and this is only like a few days. You know, it's like from 2012 Avengers to the end of this series is probably only a few days for him. And then looking at another character in the series, Sylvie, like, this is all she's known, is just apocalypses and from when she's a child, you know, just jumping from place to place. And all she's known is the TVA and its, you know, repercussions on the timeline and pruning different things and, you know, the sort of halting of chaos. And Loki as a character is meant to be the embodiment of chaos and the god of mischief. And so taking that character and kind of confronting them with this system of order and having them have to see why does this exist and why does it, you know, why does it matter? And then making decisions based off of that. You know, it's at the very end of the show. It's like Loki has only had to deal with this for a short period of time. And it kind of sees, okay, well, do we want all chaos in this case? Because it can lead to the destruction of everything I care about. And that's like an interesting thing, is the way that he has the realizations of how much his mother meant to him, how much Thor means to him. You know, you even bump into classic Loki, who was living out on an asteroid somewhere for a long period of time, you know, grows old, and then finally he's like, I want to go see my brother, you know, and it comes back down to the core of the character where it's like, really, he cares about Asgard. He cares about these people. He's too afraid to show it or express it. But in the end, he does care. He does have a heart at the end of it. You know, he might be mischievous, but in the end, he still cares. And that, you know, goes into him with Sylvie, and he cares about Sylvie and doesn't want Sylvie to get hurt. And in the end, Sylvie's at, you know, on this quest to sort of reveal the wizard behind the curtain and end, you know, this control, because it's all it's done is just brought her pain. And all she can see is her own pain. And so getting into, you know, sort of that climactic battle at the end where you have this Loki who's gone on this entire journey and is definitely further along than the MCU variant ever was. You know, he's seen more, he's experienced more and had to confront himself more than the Loki in the MCU has. And I think that's a lot of it, of confronting yourself, being forced to make these decisions, have these realizations, and then have actions based off of them. You know, it's that moment where it's like, no, he's telling the truth at the end of how he feels and he's expressing himself. He's not lying anymore.
That seemed fairly clear to me that he was finally really being, you know, truly honest at that point.
And it's the first time that you've seen that, even in the MCU. He's lying through his teeth, even to Thanos at the very end of the, you know, he might be lying for a purpose, but he's still lying the entire time. But finally, he has that character growth and that reason. And that's one of those things, if this character has gone on such a journey now, that moving forward, you know, into a season two, into the future of Marvel, this character has developed into something very different. And that's something fascinating to see. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they start going with the whole thing of him becoming the, you know, god of stories, which is what they do in the Marvel comics now, where it's like, you know, he's gone beyond his just mischievousness and now he's the god of stories. You know, whether they're, you know, true or false, you know, up to the chaos. But, you know, there you go.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, his character really has evolved a lot compared to what he did in MCU. Now, I do think that his arc in the show got him to something like where he was in Endgame, but maybe with a greater ability to, you know, love these parts of himself that he kind of had to cover up with the show. You know, before. Because, I mean, I guess he is a narcissist, but he apparently also saw himself as being fundamentally weak in some way. And so that's why he had to put on this, you know, mantle of like, you know, I have to make people fear me, because that's the whole thing that he got into in like the first or second episode when Mobius is kind of like breaking him down. He showed him like those moments from his life. And, you know, he talked about how, no, you exist to let, you know, you cause pain and death and suffering, but you bring out the best in other people. And so I think that very early on in this show, he was forced to reconcile with some parts of himself that he hadn't been forced to do, that we've seen in MCU before in this like other version of him. Although I guess now the version in this show we could probably call Loki Prime, you know, just for the sake of keeping things straight for ourselves, since this is the Loki that we're going to be following now. And so I thought that was a real interesting way to take Loki. And I thought it was also a good way to bring him up to speed in a sense, so that, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting about that, those first couple episodes when he's there talking to Mobius and he is really forced to kind of reconcile with certain parts of himself. And he, you know, kind of explains why it's the fact that he explains how he could have been like so cruel in like the first couple movies we saw him in, but yet he actually is not a person that likes to kill people and enjoys cruelty. Truly, is an evil person in that way. And I thought that that was a piece that was kind of missing from Loki before in the MCU, in that, you know, it showed us these stages of his journey. But to me, like, especially during the first Avengers, you know, he did feel a little bit like this two-dimensional villain that just wanted to, like, conquer the world. But now they actually explained his whole thing of, like, freedom is the first lie and, you know, and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Did that all make sense to you? Like, how did that come off to you?
It did, but at first it was definitely a bit of a stretch. I think getting into the beginning of the series, you're kind of looking back and you're like, okay, I've seen more of this Loki in the MCU than I have here. And in the MCU, he's not, you know, he doesn't show that he has this other side to him. It's all this, you know, facade of, you know, this rage and this whole, you know, trickster sort of thing, and, you know, all the death that he causes. But on the other side of it, you know, he's not showing that underside. He's not showing that development in any way or the reasoning behind any of his actions. Like, you don't really feel that. It is definitely part of that being a two-dimensional villain, which is what he is in that first Avengers film.
Right, right. And then I would say even more two-dimensional than in the first Thor movie in a way, too.
I would completely agree, because at least in the first Thor movie, there is a sense that, you know, he feels betrayed by his father, and
yeah,
he feels like his brother is not really, you know, his brother anymore, that they can actually be brothers. And it's one of those things of him, you know, going through the MCU, he's reconciling that, you know, over time, even to the moment where he and Thor are sitting next to each other and watching their father, you know, ascend. It's that sort of a thing that, you know, even when he's watching the video of it, he starts, you know, choking up over it, because, like, there's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was quite a few really important things that he gets out of watching that, like, highlights reel of his life, including his future that he didn't get to live. Right. Which is that, the death of both of his parents. Right. Seeing that it was kind of his fault about his mom. And when Odin goes, the fact that he says, "I love you, my sons," which is kind of something that Loki had been seeking like his whole life, right? Is like even just a simple statement. Like that might have been the first time that Odin like said that to adult, you know, Thor and Loki, I would think. And then also the fact that he'd never got a throne or ruled anything. He just bought like chaos and destruction. And then ultimately he's got kind of an ignominious end there with Thanos. I mean, I guess you could argue that he saved Thor in that moment, you know, which is noble. But I think that that really played against sort of his ideas and aspirations of himself. Would you agree?
Yeah, I feel like it's the whole thing of, again, of branching of these two different, you know, versions of Loki now, because it is the sort of thing that he sees, he gets to react to the choices that he made. But at the same time, I'm sure, just like any of us, if we saw our future, we're like, well, I'm not going to make that decision. That can't be my end.
But of course, he can't even go back to that timeline now, right?
No, he can't. Now it's the whole thing of he has this completely different path. And throughout the early parts of the series, it is the whole thing of he's still kind of being mischievous, still trying to, you know, I'm going to rule. I'm going to gain control somehow. I'm going to be sneaky and everything. And it's through following Sylvie that he realizes, yes, this isn't his story. You know, as Judge Renslayer says, you know, it is the thing of like, you know, this isn't about him necessarily, even though, you know, the show's about him. It's just that the universe, the MCU is not Loki's story. Right.
That's something that I think first the TVA is beating him over the head with that fact. And then I think it's the scene when he's confronting Sylvie's like enchanted people at the Roxxon Walmart store, whatever they call it, Roxmart or something, when she tells him, this isn't about you. I think it's like at the end of that episode when she says that. And that's, I think those, you know, moments are key in getting him to the point where at the very end, when he says to her, this is bigger than our experience. Let's at least just think about it for a minute before we make this decision that, you know, that could have huge ramifications. Okay, well, we have a lot to get to. So let's get to some of the other topics real quick here. Okay, so next question. What are your thoughts about the TVA and how they were brought to life on screen? And how do you think the TVA relates to the themes of the show?
So I think the TVA is just in itself an interesting concept, you know, and especially something that, like, you know, even myself, not really familiar with, never had really, you know, done any research on. So it just, you know, like, okay, we're going to talk about the TVA now. And so to see that brought on screen, this whole idea of this time variance authority and that they're in control, and then, you know, the sacred timeline, they have that whole sort of Jurassic Park animated intro that, you know, explains everything to the audience, which I really appreciate it as like a sort of throwback.
I love how Miss Minutes is like kind of like Mr. DNA from Jurassic Park.
It is the exact same thing.
I think Kate Herron even mentioned that was kind of like an homage or a reference to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kate Herron being the director of the show.
And just looking at that, and, you know, and even the aesthetics, the design, the whole mid-century modern thing, the fact that it feels archaic and futuristic at the same time. You know, you have this advanced teleportation technology and you can time travel and all this stuff. And, you know, you have Miss Minutes, this AI, but at the same time, you have this older aesthetic. And so, you know, it feels like this land of the lost sort of thing, like this alternate, you know, timeline sort of thing that you're like, okay, you know, this feels like it's something that's outside of our previous experiences. Already, you're introducing this concept, even, you know, from the music changing, of that this is separate from what you've experienced beforehand. And this is really hit home in the finale of the series where, you know, you go through in the intro of the Marvel credits is going through everything. And here's the MCU. It's just off here to the side of what you've been watching. But like the TVA itself, even the whole idea of it's pruning the timelines, it's doing these things. And at first, the way they talk about it as like, you know, this is just a regular thing and has to happen, you know, and in that, you know, the horror of like, and the person disappears and disintegrates, you know, and at the beginning of the series, you start seeing this, you're like, oh, these are people that you're killing, you know, for the sake of, you know, keeping things as you see them to be right.
Right.
And that's sort of Sylvie's entire thing, you know, is it's like these, you're messing with people's lives. You know, you've ruined my life. You're ruining all these people's lives. You're controlling something that you don't deserve to control. And she's fighting against that. Where Loki comes in is it's like this is a system. He doesn't understand it. And then as he goes along, you know, and as things get explained, he's much more open to the idea that like this has to be a certain way or things could go bad.
Which, you know, is I think that speaks to the power of the TVA in a sense, because Loki is literally the god of chaos and mischief. So for him to embrace, even in a small way, the imposition of order it, on such a grand scale, like you feel like they really got to him, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that harkens back to the beginning of the show when he's like trying to escape the TVA and he comes across like there's all the Infinity Stones like in some dude's desk. And he's like, yeah, we use those as paperweights. It's just, and that's also big because that's taking, because, you know, the first three phases of the MCU were all about like every time you see an Infinity Stone, it's like, oh, it's like the most powerful, you know, possible thing, and like the MacGuffin for all these movies. Now, this show is basically just saying, yeah, forget about those things. I mean, those things aren't powerful compared to what's going on now.
That was so last phase, you know.
But I think, too,
mm-hmm. even looking at the TVA, you know, kind of getting back to that core of that, there's an aspect of horror to it that these people, you know, when you start getting the aspect that these people, you know, it's like, you know, I've got you like a fish. What's a fish? Like, you're like, you know, it's comedic, but it's also kind of like, oh,
that was a clue.
Don't know anything. They don't know anything outside of the TVA. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been, their lives have been stolen from them, and now they basically work as drones, as slaves. They're the workforce, as, you know, He Who Remains calls them, which is, again, it's the whole thing of it's impersonal. It's like, you know, you get to know Mobius, and there's little parts of his previous personality, you know, the jet ski that break through, that you're like, you know, back in the past, you know, back in the 90s, this guy had a life, and then that he got plucked out of it. And even with these people, you're like, these aren't Marvel heroes or villains. These aren't people who did anything amazing or terrible. They just happen to be here. Like, they've been stolen, you know, they have their lives stolen from them. Did they do anything to branch off and create a new timeline? Who knows? But I think it's very possible that they were just, you know, plucked at random, you know, and removed.
Yeah, and, they could have just been removed from a variant timeline where they weren't the ones that made it the variant timeline. They were just happened to be in it. So, you know, rather than them all disintegrating at the void at the end of time or whatever, might as well just pluck them out and, you know, make them your TVA employees.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of those things of like, as beautiful as it can look, and as, you know, incredible as all this mid-century modern art and this, you know, sort of goofy, you know, styling, there is sort of an underpin of horror under that control that, you know, this isn't all wonderful and great, and that there is some moral complexity, which is Loki's balancing that whole thing at the very end of like, maybe we should talk about this and figure something out, you know. Maybe destroying it isn't the best option, but at the same time, leaving it as is not acceptable.
Yeah, you know, Kate Herron, I watched, you know, quite a few interviews with her, and she kept referring to like sort of the look of their technology as sort of like a retrofuturism. And you know, there's definitely a lot of, I kept thinking of the movie Brazil, Terry Gilliam's movie Brazil, if you've ever seen that, in terms of the design of it all, you know, with sort of the, you know, the old, you know, style technology that is used in maybe like a more high tech fashion and all of that. And I actually, then I was watching one of her interviews, and she even mentioned that they were kind of like thinking about Brazil and other science fiction films too. Like, she kept saying that the font on all the computers is from the first Alien movie and stuff like that. So I did really dig the design of it. And I think that the whole visual and auditory design of the show just really all like meshed really, really well. But to me, the TVA, you know, once you see the whole first season, because at first, you know, you can't quite be sure of certain details and, you know, what their mission really is and all this stuff. But like, to me, they really kind of represent the banality of evil in a sense. But, you know, you kind of mentioned it's all very impersonal for them. You know, they're all just sort of cogs in the machine, and they don't really think about it beyond that. No, they have their dogma that comes down to them from the timekeepers, right? Which we all know are BS at this point. But that frames everything they do as like this holy mission to save reality, right? The sacred timeline where they are, what was it? Loki said, you're not the arbiters of divine power. And then Mobius is like, yes, we are. Right.
Yeah.
So they have this very like established dogma kind of in the background of what they do, so that if they ever do think about it, they're like, oh, well, it's just, you know, we're servants of, you know, the sacred timeline, and please fill out your paperwork. I'm really bored. You know, I mean, it's, you know, talk about authoritarian, but like, because essentially, you know, you could say it's this huge, enormous institution dedicated to like preventing free will on a mass scale. But then at the end, you find out it's this question of utilitarianism, like, the let's create the most good for the largest number of people. And, you know, it's like the trolley car problem, right? Like if you have a trolley, out of control on the tracks and it's going to run over five people, but you can pull a lever and then it turns, but it only kills one person instead. Is that better, right? Or are you a murderer for killing that one person who would not have otherwise died, right? So I really do like that at the end they made it so that there's no easy answer to this question, you know, because you could imagine like a superhero blockbuster made 20, 30 years ago where it would have just been they're evil fundamentally and you just have to stop them and that makes everything good.
And then there's right. a big fight at the end and, you know, it's all dramatic right. and everything. And instead it's just us, right. you know, the finale is just us in a chair, you know, just sitting here having this conversation.
Right, exactly. You know, and there was conflict, you know, and there was a fight at the end, but it was between really another version of himself, of Loki, right? Mm-hmm. Which is actually, you know, going into the final episode before I watched it, I thought that there was a chance that there would be another Loki behind it all, just because thematically speaking, I thought that Loki needed to still face the darkest parts of himself in a way to kind of round out his journey in the show. And he kind of did that, but with Sylvie instead of like a King Loki or, you know, whatever at the end.
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, looking at how that show and how the TVA plays into things in that battle of, is there free will or is there not free will? Because it's clearly, you know, at the end of the show, it's clear that the MCU, there was no free will. Everything was dictated. If something wasn't according to He Who Remains, it was pruned. You know, it's like that. That's what it is. You know, the yeah. MCU, everything that we have watched in the entire Marvel. And this is what I love about, you know, the Loki series, as it puts it. Everything that you've watched is this little bottle, it's this little, you know, string. And you know, it can't deviate from that. It's all been controlled by this one old guy here at the end of time.
Yeah.
Played wonderfully by Jonathan Majors. You know, he doesn't look that old, but, you know, much older than I look.
I really dug his performance in that, by the way. And we'll talk more about him later. So, all right. So I want to talk about Sylvie. So what are your thoughts on Sylvie and, you know, Sophia DiMartino in that role in this show?
As a character, I think early on, there was a lot of discussion, debate of like, who is she? Is she Lady Loki? Is she the Enchantress? You know, what is it? And then it was clear, you know, very, you know, later on, it's both. It's the both are the answer. And even herself, like, you know, okay, she comes up, she's like, I'm not a Loki, I'm Sylvie. Like, I am this mm-hmm. now. Like, this is my identity. And even you look at her, it's like, well, she was Loki when she was a kid. And then she's plucked yeah. out of the timeline and now has lived through 1,000 apocalypses. She's not the same person as Loki would
no.
ever be.
You might even say that she's diverged more from, like, you know, the core, like, Loki persona than maybe any of the other variants, right?
She's basically a completely different person. She doesn't remember her childhood on Asgard. She doesn't really remember that. Like, there's nothing there. This is what she's known. And that plays into all her decisions later on. And so, yes, she's a variant of Loki. But she's so divergent from where a Loki would be that she is her own character. And so I kind of enjoyed that exploration of, like, well, she's evolved to this point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can even look at the character design. She has the rings on her gauntlets that are very similar to the Enchantress. But she has the head, you know, piece that's similar to Loki. And so you have these things that are all playing into it. And so early on, some people were like, well, this isn't the Lady Loki from the comics. It's like, no, this is a completely different character. Yeah. You know, this is something that we haven't seen before. And what I enjoy is when you can have a character like that that's unpredictable and we don't know where the story is going and how this all plays in together. Mm-hmm. And so the entire series, you know, we're guessing, you know, a lot of this entire Loki series might have bits and pieces from different things that have been brought in before, but it is telling its very own story that is sort of playing off of the MCU. And that's something yeah. I've enjoyed, is where the MCU, you know, diverges from anything else we've seen before. And it might slightly adapt something, but it's going to do it different because it's telling its own story.
And I think it has to. I mean, because, like, if you could imagine the MCU just doing, like, you know, shot for shot, like, you know, exact characters and things from the comics, like, okay, it could, you know, maybe it could do that in a lot of cases. But I think it would be boring in a sense, because we'd already know where it's going. I mean, not everybody's read the comics, but, like, what's the point of doing something exactly the way it's already been done? You know, mm-hmm. You have to take a little bit of artistic license. And, you know, there's conversations to be had about, like, how you have to adapt for the medium and all that kind of stuff. You know, for me, I think Sophie DiMartino was a good choice for the role in terms of casting. I liked her performance, and I think that she bears enough resemblance to Tom Hiddleston, just like in the structure of her face, that you can imagine that they're variants of the same person, you know? They kind of have like a similar nose and like cheekbones and that kind of stuff. And I also think that, you know, in terms of if you're going to do a romance with Loki, it almost has to be with himself, right? So I think the choice of her as a Loki variant makes sense from that point of view, if you're going to have that kind of like relationship in a Loki show with him. And I think that that also plays into this theme of like self-love that Kate Herron has talked about in some interviews that I've seen, right? Because he's literally learning to love himself and trust himself in a way. Yeah. Right. And then beyond all that, like kind of like you were saying, I think she's just a really interesting character. You know, she's ripped from her home as a child. You know, she's been on the run. She's grew up in all these apocalypses. And I think that one of the important aspects of that is that that experience growing up like that, and God knows how long she's been alive, how many apocalypses she's had to live through, right? Because she's an adult. And Asgardians live like 5,000 years or so, right? According to what we know. So God knows how long it's been. It's damaged her so much that at the end of it all, you can understand her lack of trust and her decision to kill Kang or Mortis at the end of the finale, even if you're still like panicking because like you don't want, you know, reality to burn or whatever.
And I think it's interesting talking about that romance and that connection, though, of like, you know, from Loki's perspective, it is this one way. And then from, you know, Sylvie's direction, it's another way. You know, they might have appreciation for one another and have feelings for one another. But ultimately, you know, for Loki, his feelings for her matter more than what's happening here. Even his decision, even at the moment where they're tempted by Miss Minutes of like, hey, we can put you back together in the timeline, we'll make it work. You know, even then, the reason that Loki doesn't say yes to that is because he knows that's not what Sylvie wants. You know, he's going along with, at a certain point, I don't feel like it's Loki who's going along and making these things. He's doing it because of Sylvie, and it's because what Sylvie needs. You know, it matters. Yeah. She matters more in this, in the end, in the finale, than his own, you know, I want to rule, I want to have a throne. That's the whole part that plays into his honesty when he's expressing himself. But at the same time, he's holding himself back. He can't admit that he loves her, which I, you know, I find that the whole time you're playing that whole like, will they, won't they sort of thing. And when she, you know, pulls him in and they kiss, but she does it for, you know, to switch with him.
For tricksy reasons. She's a tricksy hobbit
there. And that's where you get down to, she's still Loki. Deep down within there, she's still Loki.
I thought it was nice in that scene, too, when Kang, I'm just going to call him Kang, when Kang was serving them tea or whatever, and he called them both Loki. That was a nice little reminder that actually, you know, she is a Loki variant still. Yeah, his performance was great in that. You know, I do want to talk about this relationship between them a little bit further, between Loki and Sylvie. So would you say, is it cool? Is it multiversal masturbation? Is it incest? What is it? How did it strike you? A lot of people have been uncomfortable with it, I would say, you know, so what's your take?
I wasn't uncomfortable by it in any way. And I think it's mostly because it's like alternate reality, like craziness. Like at that point when you're playing with the multiverse and you're playing with like, no, in our reality, there's no way that you would be able to meet another version of yourself that exists from parallel dimension and thus fall in love with them. That's not going to happen.
It's the multiverse.
So, you know, you're already playing along with comic book craziness. And so at that point, like, I'm not going to judge, you know, we're going to leave it here. But I do think that there's, you know, for those who were kind of like creeped out by it in some way or whatever it is, you know, I think that, you know, okay, you know, maybe that's something that you're not okay going along with. He's an Asgardian god. I don't know what's up. It's Norse mythology, man. There's a lot of weird stuff in there if you'd start digging around.
I'm
going to leave it as is.
They have different mores, social mores.
It's a different culture. How can your moral be unto gods, you know?
Unto gods. Meeting alternate multiverse versions of themselves. Yeah, I mean.
At that point, there's no, you know, I can't, you know.
Yeah. I wasn't getting hung up on it either, but I just find the reaction kind of interesting, because if you think about it, it is sort of somebody falling in love with and, you know, kissing and, you know, themselves in a way. And I guess if you really think about it, I guess you could make an argument that it's slightly incestual if they both have the same parents, except from different universes. But I'm willing to accept that they are different characters and that they are allowed to have a romantic relationship if they want.
If it was the Loki from the MCU meeting this variant Loki from the timeline and then they kissed, that would be very different from...
They're closer related, right? That's a little...
Yeah, that's like you're literally like the same people versus like Sylvie is so divergent from Loki at this point, which is why she calls herself Sylvie, is like she's not a Loki anymore. Yeah. She's so divergent at this point that the two of them are very different characters.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it came down to, if it's like, and even down to the whole thing of like leaning more towards the Enchantress direction than the Loki direction. It's even the whole thing of the way they fight and even meeting classic Loki and the whole thing of, you know, Loki's, you know, sorcery, nothing can match it. You know, your knives are nothing.
Right. So a question that just occurred to me, though, is what do you think would happen if they had a baby? If they had tried to have a baby, what would that baby be?
Well, I think already if you're dealing with alternate universes, and they're going to get into this with the MCU or whatever it is, where it's like, it's Tony Stark, but it's a different actor playing Tony Stark.
Right.
You're going to get into the whole thing of, because you have alternate timelines and different things that genetically, you know, it's a whole thing of like, you know, you're going to be a different person, even though.
Well, she's obviously genetically different. She's a woman, whereas, you know, he's a man. So she's got at least half of her DNA different.
I don't know how multiversal, you know, DNA and genetics work. That's going to be that's some science.
I'm neither a quantum physicist nor a geneticist. I don't feel qualified to make those kind of judgments.
We'll get Professor Hulk on board and we'll have that conversation.
I'd love to hear what he would have to say about that, actually. Okay, so now I want to talk about Loki and Mobius. So what are your thoughts on the relationship between Loki and Mobius and, you know, and how it develops from the beginning? And how do you think they helped each other grow? And of course, the question that's on everybody's mind, will Mobius ever get to ride his jet ski?
I think what Mobius brought to the series is like he's the breakout star. You know, every time that Mobius was in there, every time Mobius was off screen, you're wondering what's happening with Mobius. And that's you know, good character. You know, that's how you know you have something. And it is the thing that he is the character that represents the TVA and represents everyone who works for the TVA.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, because you care about Mobius, now you care about B-15, right?
Right,
right.
He
never gave her another name. Yeah, I forget. The numbers and letters thing starts to get, you know, wonky. But you start caring about the other characters and about, you know, okay, they do matter. And even, you know, you're implying those whole ideas, you know, with the jet ski, with this magazine, with all the 90s paraphernalia that Mobius is constantly pulling out. You're like, you had a history that got stolen from you.
Well,
oh,
he really humanizes the TVA. Like, to your point, like, he does represent the TVA, you know, especially in the beginning, I would say. But then, you know, when they have that conversation about the jet ski magazine, it also really humanizes not just him, but by proxy, the TVA, right? Because he's saying, well, it's just reminding me of why we're doing all this, you know, to preserve, you know, a good, you know, reality and timeline for everybody else. And also, you know, he's a true believer at that point, too. So that's part of him really, you know, kind of embodying the TVA. So
going forward, you know, with that character, it is the thing that, you know, OK, we've only experienced some of his journey along with Loki. But now you're looking at in a post, you know, He Who Remains universe and whatever else that implies. You know, where does that character go? And even the whole idea, you know, that's proposed there of like, well, Loki can go back and you rule the TVA as a benevolent ruler. And, you know, they can reveal the truth and, you know, make decisions from there, you know, say, hey, you know, I think the problem, too, is like any of these characters who have been plucked from their timeline and turned into, you know, the workforce for the TVA, when they reset the timeline, another version of themselves lives on and lives their life. They're just now separate.
Yeah.
And so they can't just go back into the timeline and just go and, you know, rediscover themselves and join their, you know, family or whatever it is. They're now separate.
Yeah, they're part of the timeline.
Now that there's a multiverse, now, you know, anything can happen. Now it doesn't really matter as much. But yeah. for them, you know, it would be interesting to posit, hey, if they had gone back and, you know, revealed everything, how many of them would have chosen to try and get back to their timeline? And how many of them would still feel like they need to stay? That their yeah. mission, you know, despite it doesn't matter who's in charge, their mission of trying to control the chaos of time still mm-hmm. mattered in the end. Because I think that's one of yeah. the fair things of, like, you know, if you talk to Mobius, and I'm excited to get into this in a potential season two, and, you know, whenever this happens, mm-hmm. is the whole thing of, like, what are the ramifications now for these different characters? And,
oh, man.
You know, yeah. even at the end of the show, do they remember what they had learned? Or did everything get reset? Have things branched so far? Like, what even happened to the TVA? You know, this gets into the end when Mobius is standing there and is like, you know, who are you? Like, I don't, you know, Mobius now doesn't remember who Loki is. Or is it the case that Loki has now fallen into a different TVA and the Mobius that we know is off somewhere else now?
Yeah, those are really good questions that we are going to get into soon. Trust me. You know, I thought that it was a great duo. I think Owen Wilson was really great in that role. It's, you know, it's kind of, he had this like calm confidence and dry wit that I think was maybe the perfect foil to Loki, you know, who generally, at least in the beginning, is to a point where he generally expects to either intimidate or trick or bewilder people, basically. And Mobius just wasn't having it, you know. And I think that, to the jet ski question, I think that's something they planted that they're going to pay off by the end of the series, right? Like maybe... And God knows how many seasons they're even going to have, you know, but I think I feel like it would be a real missed opportunity if they didn't pay that off at some point. But I feel like the most natural point for them to pay it off would be at the very end after they've resolved whatever it is. And, you know, he gets to have his moment or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And I going back to just, you know, the performance and everything like that, it's such an everyman thing, you know, that character.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's so likable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that people gravitate towards is like, he's just, you know, just a likable guy. And that's, you know, thanks Owen Wilson.
Yeah. And he's like he's so down to earth. You know, he's such a very down to earth, like likable guy. And that I think helps sell the TVA, honestly, you know, because mm-hmm. if you have somebody in that role who is just out there and is like, you know, embodies the weirdness of the TVA somehow and, you know, the quirkiness of their, you know, behavior or something like that, then that could make it tougher to really get into the concept of the TVA. Or, you know, maybe it just makes it so conspicuous that you're constantly having to like get back into your suspension of disbelief or something. I just think that he was like perfectly cast in that role, basically.
And I think Mobius as a character helps so much to helping like make the TVA approachable as like somebody who might not be familiar with it or is like, okay, we're getting to multiversal stuff. Like, oh boy, like, I don't know what's going to happen here. Well, here's just basically an office drama, you know,
yes.
Here's just like an office drama show.
Yeah.
You know, even though it's dealing with all this multiversal stuff at its core, it's just, here's this character, here's this thing. And so it helps it. And I think that's one of the brilliant things with Kevin Feige. Mm-hmm. Is that he can take something that's incredibly complicated and just present it in a simple enough way that it is consumable to a lot
yes.
of people. And that helps of like, it, you know, this might not be the most approachable show, but if we fill it with approachable characters and characters that you care
right.
about, well, then everything else is easier to sell.
Right.
And everything else, it works
right.
better.
And I think one of the things that they've been very good at doing in the MCU, and this is probably credit to Kevin Feige and his choices for, you know, the people he's chosen to you know, to helm these installments of the MCU, is like, A, you have this emotional realism in the characters where they're reacting to this crazy comic booky stuff as if it's real in an emotionally real way, right? And then B, you also have... I think one of the things that a movie or a show can do to deal with crazier plot elements to make, you know, to get people into it and allow them to kind of suspend their disbelief a little easier is you literally have a character or somebody like say how crazy it is. Right. And you get it and you turn it into a joke and you get a laugh. But then that allows people to say, OK, they're acknowledging it to. Now we're all in it together. Like, let's move on. Like, I feel like there were moments when Loki was reacting to the craziness of it, right?
This is absurd.
Right, exactly. And so I think, you know, you have other moments of that in the MCU and also other, you know, other movies and TV shows. And I think that's especially when you turn it into a joke and you allow people to laugh, right? That sort of eases the tension that I think can come along with looking at something and being like, this is kind of weird and unrealistic. But then you have that sort of moment of, you know, of like humorous catharsis or whatever it is. And that allows you to kind of go along on the rest of the journey. So that was definitely something that I liked about it. So next question I had for you is, what were the most exciting things you saw in the show that like really made you geek out, and why was it those elements of the show?
I think moments where, you know, even in the early episodes where you would look out and you would see the TVA and this massive complex thing, yeah. And it's the scale of it all. Mm. That you had the realization this isn't going to be Falcon the Winter Soldier. This isn't going to be, you know, sort of something that's, you know, smaller Earthbound. It isn't even cosmic scale. It's different. Mm-hmm. It's something that you haven't seen before. And so, you know, to be exploring a part of the MCU that doesn't, you know, you don't have the context for mm-hmm. yet is amazing, because it feels like you're going in a new direction, that, you know, you're branching off and that we are actually starting a new journey. You know, Phase 4 is beginning. And so in a way, when you're looking at the show and you're like seeing these little moments where it, you know, sort of hints at the larger universe, now that you have the possibility of a multiverse, even the whole thing of pruned elements, like especially in episode 5, mm-hmm. episode 5 is a wealth of Easter eggs, the Thanos copter,
my God.
Throg, you know,
King
all these
Tower,
things, the different Loki,
you know, so many things. There's even the head of the Living Tribunal in there. Did you see that? Yeah.
Head of the Living Tribunal. Yep. And that implies these different things. And some of them, even like the character of classic Loki, which right. is basically just Loki from the comic book.
Right.
That's who he is just here.
And I think you can also make an interesting argument that he's just the Loki we know from the main MCU timeline, but like older in a variant timeline where he faked his death at the hands of Thanos, right? Because that's kind of what he talked about.
That's kind of what they imply, yeah. But then in the behind the scenes when they're talking mm-hmm. about it, like that's what he thought. That's what he acted.
Okay.
He's like, oh yeah, I'm just playing older you. And everybody's, no, you're classic Loki. So it mm-hmm. implies that, yes, that's potentially where it is, but it's also like, imagine the MCU, but they're all wearing comic accurate
right?
That's basically what it is. Imagine the comics are accurate and there's a Thanos copter flying in and Thanos is in it in his comic accurate costume, you know? It's like, there mm-hmm. you go. That's what that universe
was. What great
was.
Casting for classic Loki, too. He did so well.
You get one episode, but glorious purpose. Mm-hmm. Glorious purpose. Gosh. It is those things, though, where you'd have little references, little things pop mm-hmm. up, you know, that you're, like, geeking out over. If like, look at that. Like, that's amazing. Like, look at this. You know, even characters like Ravonna Renslayer, when she shows up, from the moment she shows up in episode 1.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, that's Ravonna Renslayer. That's the lover of...
Right, and like the fact that it's like, it's her and not some other random TVA judge or something tells you that something is up with her, or that she has a further role to play or something, right? You know, that she's mm-hmm. going to be involved. And I take it you've read a lot of the comics too, right?
I have not read a lot of the comics, but I'm familiar with them, like just doing research,
gotcha.
Looking things up online, putting things
gotcha.
Together. It's just simply one of those things of the Marvel, you know, comics like database is so large at this
huge.
Point that it's, you know,
yeah.
for me to jump in mm-hmm. is often like a difficult thing unto
yeah.
itself. So it is like, you know, occasionally I'll be like, okay, new X-Men when that was being mm-hmm. rebooted was, you know, in the comics was sort of like, oh, I want to jump onto this and see how this you
yeah.
know, works.
Yeah.
And now also seeing, oh, here's the new stuff. This is what could potentially bleed into the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
The MCU is more of what I care about.
Mm-hmm.
I use the comics as a way of seeing and connecting to different things.
Yeah.
You know, in Infinity War, when the snap happened, my sister didn't know what was happening, and I was losing my
right,
mind.
Right, right.
I'm like, this is it.
Right.
This is it. And she's like looking in horror, and I'm like super excited. It was great.
Yeah, I'm in a similar place in that, like, I didn't actually have the opportunity to read a whole lot of comics growing up. But I have done like some research on like the Marvel Wiki and stuff like that for a lot of the Mecha Dragon episodes we've done. But I have tried to read some of them. And like, for example, I actually had read a lot of the Miss Marvel series from when it started in like 2012, I think it was, like something like that. You know, and so I try to get into it, but my God, there's a lot of content to read. So it's kind of hard.
And continuity.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the big things that, and this is two parts of it. You know, when it comes to the MCU, you know, the continuity is easier to condense and contain. Mm-hmm. It's easier to understand. It's digestible, you know, as films and television are. But when you look at the comics, it's a lot more difficult to say, here is a jumping off point.
Right, right.
You know, and even though the comics, they'll set up those points, the fact that you have a continuously evolving universe means whenever there's a callback to some story that you've never read before,
you've no
or
idea,
there's
yeah.
an Easter egg or some reference, you don't know what's yeah. going on. And so sometimes that would be the case where it's like, oh, I'm jumping on, but then I'm also watching all these YouTube videos right. and recaps of all these other right. comic books.
Thank God for all the wonderful YouTube creators like Comic Books Explained and like people that can actually like have read all this stuff like throughout their whole life, you know. So that's yep. great. So, you know, for me, I just love cosmic multiverse stuff. Like, I want to see parallel universes. I want to see variant characters. I want to see how it, like, all intertwines and affects the whole MCU. Mm-hmm. Like, I just found the TVA so interesting, like, in its visual design, the music, this whole new, like, element underlying the whole MCU. You know, it's sort of has had its fingers in, like, direct, like, curating the whole MCU in a way. You know, it kind of implies all that.
The TVA is Kevin Feige.
Yeah, basically, he's the...
It's the writer's room at Marvel. That's the writer's room.
That was
there.
Behind one of the other doors at the Citadel there at the end of time. Yeah.
I do want to say, though, that, like, looking at something like the TVA, the art style, the music, everything, that is unique to this medium. Like, this is created for the show. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have inspirations in the comics. This is another thing that, like, you can go read a comic, but just because it's there in the comic doesn't mean that that's going to be the one-for-one translation of, like, this is what you're now going to see in the MCU. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's like, we're going to bring this comics-accurate costume in. We're going to bring this whole thing in. You know, even seeing He Who Remains and seeing his robes and the way everything is designed, that's the Immortus costume just brought into the MCU. Like, that's what
I mean,
he's
basically Immortus, right? They just kind of combined him with He Who Remains.
Yeah.
And actually...
Which is interesting.
I was...
Getting into that, He Who Remains being a character that is supposed to, you know, in the comics already established as the founder of the TVA, the last you know, agent of the TVA who then goes back and starts it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of an endless loop. But in this case, you know, combining characters.
I read in an interview, or maybe it was like a video interview, something that was originally the concept was it was going to be He Who Remains, but it was a much later decision to actually make it a variant of Kang. And make it an Immortus. And so I'm not sure exactly how that creative decision came to happen, but I kind of dig it. Are you cool with the merging of the characters, or do you see it as problematic?
So, you know, beginning to get into Kang, I have been fascinated with the character of Kang the Conqueror since I encountered him in a cartoon series when I was younger called Earth's Mightiest Heroes, which you can find on Disney Plus, which is kind of like the Justice League animated series for Marvel.
Uh-huh.
So it's very much a, like, you know, this, if you just showed this to somebody, they'd be able to, like, just watch and see a whole bunch of, you know, they have Age of Ultron, they have these different stories in there. You know, they actually do a Kang story in there that also sets up the Kree-Skrull War later on. Like, you know, it actually plays into it. But the character of Kang, the way he interacts with the Avengers, is just a fascinating character to me. So then doing research, and his incarnation in that show was a lot more sort of put together than he often is in the comics, which is one of those things that is surprising to me, the fact that they're even bringing in Kang. Because Kang has not always been brought in a solid way. You know, sometimes in the comics he shows up and he just kind of messes with everything and it doesn't go well. And so even just to say we're going to do this because it's going to get complicated, that's the whole thing with the character. Yeah. But, you know, looking at Immortus, who is Immortus? Immortus is the ultimate version of what Kang becomes. At the very end, Kang reconciles with himself, looks back at his history, and is not so happy of who he became. Mm. And so in the comics, he helps the TVA try and stop his former self. It is that thing of combining the two characters of the founder of the TVA along with Kang the Conqueror, or like Immortus. They are similar enough that combining them together isn't a problem. And it implies this whole thing of, you know, he saw himself. He sees everything. You know, it also implies that he's Kang Prime. He's the original. You know, he's the original person who figured out this stuff. And then he lives to see, you know, himself destroying everything and potentially unraveling reality itself, you know, when he sees the danger with himself. So he's trying to prevent that. even having a Mortis implies, you know, several things. Mm. A character such as Iron Lad, a right. younger version of Kang, who starts and helps found the Young Avengers, which we're already seeing those characters pop up.
Right.
There's the whole thing that Kang's going to get wrapped up into everything.
Yeah, it's
and
fascinating.
And that's where it just, the journey begins here. And they, you know, we knew that they had cast Jonathan Majors for Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, but that still, we didn't know that that was going to lead into, you know, Immortus showing up at the end of Loki. You know, yeah. I had hopes because you had Ravonna Renslayer and this and that. So much of the series alludes to Kang, you know, again, Kang Tower, like there, you know, oh, it's Avengers Tower, uh-huh. but it's changed, you know, that's directly from the comics that, you know, it's implying these things. That's just an Easter egg, but it helps formulate that this show in the end was building to something. Mm-hmm. And to have even a show, this isn't in a movie, to have a show be that kickoff point where now reality has branched
off. Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, I was maybe a little surprised that, you know, that we got to see sort of like the birth of the multiverse or maybe the rebirth, whatever, you're outside of time witnessing it. But, you know, which is obviously, to me, going to have so many repercussions and like everything that's going to happen in the MCU moving forward. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But, you know, were you happy and satisfied with like all these reveals at the end of the show and like the last couple of episodes, really? In terms of Kang, you know, the multiverse, the timeline, like, you know, his whole story and all of that. Did that work for you?
The way that played out, even though that's the B plot, you know, the A plot is Sylvie and Loki. Right. The B plot is Kang, the multiverse, the expansion of all of this and setting up all of Phase 4. And the way they went about it might have been a little bit different than people would expect. This isn't, you know, giant blue face turns to pan camera, yeah. but you know, yeah. it is one of those things that this, you know, even having those things of putting the Infinity Stones to mm-hmm. bed, like literally like putting them in a drawer, showing they don't really matter anymore. You know, that they're a fun MacGuffin, but that's the last, you know,
right.
phases.
We're
now
past that.
We're moving forward towards much greater and bizarre things happening.
Mm-hmm.
But getting into Kang and like the way he's revealed on screen, you know, even that performance of just this sort of wacky guy, he is the man behind the curtains from, you know, Wizard
yeah.
of Oz. You know, it is that
yeah.
whole thing. If he's jumping on the desk, he's eating his apple, he's being wild. And Jonathan Majors talks about how this portrayal, this, you know, this whole character is to show the very end of Kang's journey, to show a contrast between this guy who's grown old and is tired of what he's been for the last, you know, millennia, that now he, you know, it's time for him to move on. It's time for somebody else to take over or for him to die and then for everything to be reborn. It is the sort of thing that you're showing this character and then in contrast what Kang will be. And Kang is something that can be terrifying and threatening. And that's one of those exciting things of like, we don't know what's going to happen. Even, you know, he remains being there, being unpredictable, jumping up and, you know, yelling sometimes and being, you know, reactive in this way. It is the thing, if you don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And that chaotic nature, even though he might be slightly more benevolent.
Right, right. Yeah, I
still is the thing of there's some danger.
And, you know, there's this element of his performance that says to me that, like, he has been cooped up in this citadel for, like, millennia by himself. So he's, you know, that's why he's, like, so thrilled when they get there and he's, like, interacting with them. And also, like, he knows that he's going to give them this choice, right? And he doesn't, you know, at a certain point, he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen after that. And, you know, it's like he said, it's like, what's the worst that could happen? You know, I'm going to end up back here anyways if you kill me, you know.
Which does imply also that this is a cycle,
yeah.
that this happens. Again, reincarnation, baby, as he says, is the whole thing that, like, this is a cycle that has happened. So how many, you know, universes have there been?
Yeah.
You know, where there, how many sacred timelines have there
right.
been where Immortus ends up at the end of it? And that, what does that imply also for the future of the MCU?
Right.
You know, where does this go?
Right.
Then? You know, is this the cycle? But also he implies that choice of that, you know, maybe he doesn't, he goes off and he retires and Loki and Sylvie take over.
Yeah.
And now, you know, Loki and Sylvie are taking over the place of Immortus and guiding the sacred timeline and doing whatever they want
to
do.
That would be interesting.
Well, that's one of those things too, of he did offer a choice of that way, but at the same time, we're going right back into that loop. Right back
yeah.
in, and now Kang's everywhere and Multiverse of Madness. And
yeah.
goodness.
Goodness indeed. Well, that wraps up our discussion of Loki Season 1, and we have a lot more to say about how the show affects the MCU moving forward and everything that follows. Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, The Eternals, Spider-Man No Way Home, as you said, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Hawkeye, Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, and everything else, including Loki Season 2. Now, since there's quite a lot more to this conversation, I decided to split it into two episodes, and you can listen to the rest on Monday, August 9th, in which we discuss what Loki Season 1 means for the future of the MCU. This episode about Loki Season 1 dropped Wednesday, August 4th, so the rest of our discussion will be available in less than a week. So, Fred, I just want to thank you for coming on to the show. This has been a really fun conversation. We got to really geek out hardcore on Loki. And can you just tell the folks at home where they can find you online and what you're doing?
Absolutely. Again, I'm the host of Imagine Tomorrow, a podcast about where the future meets themed entertainment. You can reach me on Twitter at Helms and Freddy. You can reach the podcast at Terminus Terra on all social media platforms. I'm also working on a podcast called The Spirit of Adventure, which focuses on the building universe that is the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, which is potentially being set up in the new Jungle Cruise film and even spun off into its own Disney Plus series. So just talking about theme parks, talking about the way that we experience them and everything that that implies. So you can check me out there. And it's been a real pleasure coming on and talking about Loki and everything Marvel, which... Even talking about theme parks, we have Avengers that now exists.
Can't wait.
Even with the Eternals, they are casting the Eternals for Avengers Campus. So we can't wait to see them out there in the land. That's one of the fun things that you know, something we didn't talk about with Loki, is that as the show went about, every time Loki changed his costume, he would show up in Avengers Campus wearing that costume. And that's one of those things that, like, going forward, whenever anything happens in the MCU, the fact that you could go walk into California Adventure, go to Avengers Campus, and just see that character now walking around, I cannot wait until Kang the Conqueror is walking around.
That's so cool.
Just, you know, we've now crossed the threshold. We've crossed the threshold.
I can't wait to go, and also someday to take my kids. That'll be a real thrill.
Absolutely. Let me know when you do.
Absolutely.
Great,
man.
Conversation for next.
Yeah.
Time.
Oh yeah. I'm sure. Actually, maybe we'll have to talk after I finally get to go to Galaxy's Edge too, because I've really wanted to go there. So I'm still waiting for some of the pandemic stuff to cool down. But you know, but once that happens, I'm totally there. But and everybody should check out your episode on the reopening of Disneyland. It's some very helpful and interesting information. So with that, I will bid everyone adieu. I want to thank everybody at home for listening. You can find Mecha Dragon online at, we have a Facebook group and a Facebook page. We also have, links will be down below and in the show notes for our podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at Mecha Dragon Show. We have an Instagram, Mecha Dragon Show. And you can also email us at mechadragonshow@gmail.com if you would like to... if you have any comments, questions, point out the things that I got wrong, I would love to read them. Thanks, everybody. Until next time, this is Captain Will, signing out. Our music is Overworld by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.